Hello, and welcome to Beat Cafe, a weekly program sponsored by Offbeat Magazine that explores the music scene in New Orleans and the broader reach of Louisiana. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat and host of this program. Offbeat is a proud supporter of WHIV 102.3 FM. I encourage you to visit offbeat.com to read our new digital edition for October, featuring a cover story about Dana Kurtz, a singer-songwriter whose music is a blend of jazz, folk, pop, and blues. You may also know her as the lead singer in the band Lulu and the Broadsides. You'll also find feature stories about Nathan and the Zydeco Cha-Chas, John Fogerty, Johnny Vidakovich, and Chapel Hart. Check out our album reviews, live music listings, original photos and videos, plus podcasts of past episodes of Beat Cafe with your subscription at offbeat.com or follow us on social media at Offbeat Magazine. The Best of the Beat Awards will return on November 10th at the New Orleans Jazz Museum. This year's Lifetime Achievement Award will honor blues man Little Freddie King. Check out the lineup of music acts and ticket information by visiting offbeat.com and be sure to vote in 38 categories. My first guest on this episode is Dan Storper, CEO and founder of the Putumayo World Music Label. For the past 25 years, Putumayo has become known for its joyful compilations of international music, ranging from Celtic ballads and Brazilian bossa nova to Louisiana's own jazz and Cajun music and Zydeco. The latest release from Putumayo is an album Dan co-curated with Linda Ronstadt, titled Feels Like Home, Songs from the Sonoran Borderlands, Linda Ronstadt's Musical Odyssey. In the second half hour, I will be joined by Brandon Broussard, a school educator originally from Lafayette, Louisiana, who's recently relocated to New Orleans. Brandon has been a longtime teacher of Louisiana's traditional dance, and he is organizing a cultural immersion weekend from October 21st to the 23rd at multiple venues across New Orleans, with a focus on music, food, cultural demonstrations, and of course, dance. So welcome to Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson, host of this program, and I am thrilled today to be joined by Dan Storper. He is the founder and CEO of the Putumayo World Music, a record label that specializes in compilations of world music, jazz, and blues. The latest issue by the label is a work co-curated by Dan and Linda Ronstadt. The title is Feels Like Home, Songs from the Sonoran Borderlands. It was released on September 30th, and it is in tandem with a new memoir by Linda, which will be released on October 4th, about her childhood growing up in southern Arizona near the Mexican border. This album has a very illustrious list of guest artists, including Lalo Guerrero, Rye Cooter, Dolly Parton, Emmylou Harris, Neil Young, Taj Mahal, and David Hidalgo. Quite impressive, Dan, and welcome to the show.
Well, great to be here. Thanks, David.
So, Dan, of course, Putumayo has put out many, many albums over the years. Of course, this is the latest. Tell me how this one specifically came to be.
Sure. Well, you know, it's not something we have ever really done before. So I got a call in December of last year from the publisher of Heyday Books, an old friend of mine, who was telling me about a project that he was working on with Linda Ronstadt. It was basically a book that was a memoir that she was writing about growing up in the borderlands area of southern Arizona. And it was a reflection and is a reflection of the inspirations that she felt as a child in that area that led to her interest in Mexican music. And ultimately, she recorded three albums of Mexican music, the first of which was the best-selling Spanish language album in the history of the U.S. to that point, and I think still to this day. And then also, you know, the food and kind of the cultural influences. And because she was not necessarily known until then as someone who had a connection to the border, her background, her father was Mexican, her historical family went back, actually had a German and Mexican connection and Spanish connection. So she was very intrigued by her roots, and also because members of her family were big musical explorers. She had an aunt who was a great aunt who actually traveled the world a little bit like Alan Lomax discovering music. So anyway, the publisher called me and said, Linda and I were talking, and we thought it wouldn't be cool if we could get an album release along with the memoir release, and we'd love you to do it. And I said, well, that's a little different than anything I've ever done before, but it took me a moment to say yes. And ultimately, they sent me a list of about 50 songs that were influential, that most of which were listed and commented on in her book, Feels Like Home, that's coming out on October 4th. And I used that as the basis to curate a selection of songs that would fit through the Putumayo prism, which is also, you know, has its own gestalt, its own aesthetic, which is to try and find songs that are universal, that appeal to people of all ages and backgrounds, that can be played over and over again without getting tired of them. And so the idea is that, you know, from that original list, we kind of cut it down to the songs that I thought were the most important, and a combination of reflections of her musical influences with songs that she recorded, sometimes with other celebrities, as you mentioned, singers like even Dolly Parton, Emmy Lou Harris, Jackson Browne actually didn't sing with her, but we included a song of his on the album that was very important about the borderlands and immigration. And I think she wanted to make a statement also, and that's an important part of both the book and the album, which was that, you know, if you grow up on the border, whether you're on one side or the other, the people are somewhat similar. And in her attitude, it's not about demonizing these people, but understanding that, you know, we're all kind of part of the same region. And this region is called the Sonoran Borderlands. Anyway, so Feels Like Home, which is the name of the book, and also the name of the album that's coming out this week, actually today as we speak, is really a compilation of songs that inspired Linda in her youth and growing up. And some are recorded by her, some are recorded by others who have done a great job with the music.
So how did you assemble all these guest artists? Was that just Linda's?
Well, I must confess that most of these songs were already recorded. It was not a special recording for this album. So part of the idea of curation that Putumayo does, and we've occasionally gone into the studio to record new songs, but generally it's a compilation of existing music, most of which people don't know much about. And I think what we say at Putumayo is that the world is this vast ocean of music. And the idea is, by combination of traveling and increasingly using the internet and connections that we have with artists all over the world, we source an incredible amount of music and then try and distill it down thematically to albums that make sense for us aesthetically and we think people would find appealing. And that process can take, you know, typically anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half. And usually the theme dictates, of course, the music that we select.
So let's go back to the very beginning, which I know starts in 1975. You opened a retail store in New York, Putumayo, selling handicrafts around the world. Now, how did that start? And how did you come up with the name Putumayo?
Well, I think this all comes full circle in an interesting way. So I have an aunt and uncle. My aunt passed away a number of years ago. My uncle is still going at 98. And he was invited to give lectures. He's an endocrinologist in Mexico. And as a matter of luck, he invited me to join the family as they took a summer trip through Mexico. About a month with the family, and then I spent a month with my cousin working in archaeological excavation my aunt was connected to through her professor. And so I had this magical summer when I was 16 in 1967 in Mexico, and decided that I would major in Latin American studies. I loved handicrafts. And then after I graduated, I visited South America to explore the countries that I'd studied, and found these great handicrafts that I thought Americans would really like, and decided to start a little import business. And so for the first year in 1974, I was running around peddling, I guess you could say, the crafts to anywhere from museum shops. Actually, my most successful venture was selling a lot of Amazonian baskets to Bloomingdale's. But by 1975, I thought, you know, I think it's time for me to open a little shop and stop running around. So that was the beginning. But my aunt and uncle, who at the time were living in Massachusetts, ultimately moved to Tucson. And so over the last 30 years, I visited them many times. They were big fans of Linda's. And one of the lovely things is that I was with my uncle last year, beginning of this year, actually, in March, when I was actually trying to decide on which songs of Linda's to include in the album. So we're driving around the Borderlands region and playing the music. So that's one of the things I like, is the opportunity to play the music in it, the setting. And so, you know, what Putumayo really began as was a Latin American handicraft business. I then started traveling around the world, importing from places like Afghanistan, India, Nepal, Indonesia. And then eventually, after kind of realizing that clothing was what sold best more than the handicrafts, I expanded more clothing and it ultimately had 7 retail stores. And then kind of people may have heard this story before, but I was coming back from Indonesia, from Bali, and I was walking through Golden Gate Park to go to an exhibit at a museum in the park and saw this African band that I flipped over. And the band was playing absolutely wonderful, upbeat Nigerian music. And the crowd was in such good spirits, was dancing, people of all backgrounds and ages having a good time in this setting in the park. And I was struck by that. And then I went back to New York, walked into one of my stores, and they were playing thrash metal music. And I said, I don't think so. I think I have to kind of figure out what kind of music fits the vibe and the aesthetic of the store. And that is what led me to the process of creating tapes of music to play for the stores. And that led to people commenting constantly, I need to buy this. Where is this? How do I find it? And because I happen to know a record label owner from a nonprofit organization I belong to, I approached him about doing a compilation. And that was the beginning in 1993 of starting what turned into a record label of Putumayo.
And what was that first compilation? What type of music was that?
Well, the first two came out together. One was a kind of a world vocal, some of the favorite songs that people loved when I played them in the stores. And this was, you know, all kinds of legends from Miriam Makeba, Jorge Ben, and Gilberto Gil from Brazil and others. And then a world instrumental album. So those two came out at the same time in 93.
Of course, ultimately, this world music landed in New Orleans in Louisiana. Your first two CDs or albums of our native music here came out in 2000, Zydeco and Louisiana Gumbo. Tell me how that came to be and what ultimately drew you here.
Sure. I was always attracted to New Orleans. I must say that when I first went to Jazz Fest in 94, I really felt like I found a place that had, you know, so much of what I liked about my travels around the world. You know, this idea that you were exploring, you had architecture and a cultural music and other types of reflections of the history of Spanish and French influences in America and a very Caribbean feel. So I said, this kind of combines a lot of the best aspects of what I find appealing around the world in my travels. And so I said, I'm going to come as often as I can to Jazz Fest. I'm not a big Mardi Gras guy, but I'm a big music fan. And so I came pretty much every other year, I guess. And eventually when I was in New York one day, I met a woman from New Orleans who was living in New York. And we started dating, and one thing led to another. We got married and decided to have a kid. And when the kid was born, we said, you know, maybe raising him in New York is not the best idea. And she missed New Orleans. And I've told a lot of people that I think the best export New Orleans has is its women, because they go out in the world and they bring their men back to New Orleans. They don't always love living in these other, especially cold climates like New York. Anyway, so I came back and, we actually were going to buy a pied-à-terre and spend time when we could get to New Orleans, and ultimately decided, no, let's do the whole hog. We bought a house, fixed it up, and moved down here. When I say move down here, it wasn't a full-time move for me because my company was still based in New York. So I tell people for about 10 or 15 years, I lived on JetBlue. So pretty much every week I'd be flying back and forth, and JFK Airport and New Orleans Airport became my places I ended up spending more time sometimes than my office or my family. Not exactly, but you know, you get the idea. And then when I finally moved down full time 7.5 years ago, is when I kind of got really connected to New Orleans. So going back to 2000, when I did the first Zydeco and Louisiana Gumbo albums, the first reflections of Louisiana music in Putumayo's repertoire, it was really about going to, I think, the Jazz Fest in 98 or 99 and being floored by some of the great Zydeco and just the eclectic assortment of musicians that would play at Jazz Fest. And so I said, let's see if we can put together a Zydeco collection, and then trying to figure out what this gumbo album would be, and called it Louisiana Gumbo. And those were the first two. And I was very lucky because, you know, a lot of people were very helpful. WWOZ opened up their library to me, let me listen and look, and everyone gave me suggestions. I didn't want to embarrass myself or Putumayo by not including somebody or having songs that really, you know, missing certain songs. And you always do. I mean, you can't possibly find every last song and every last artist for any compilation. And licensing and repertoire is also an issue. Finding who owns it, if someone still does, and getting approval is a whole process in and of itself.
Well, we'll be right back. We're going to take a brief pause for the cause, and I'll be back for more conversation with Dan Storper, the founder and CEO of Putumayo Music.
The vibe of the city for human rights and social justice, WHIV 102.3 FM.
And we're back with Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson, host of this program. I am joined today by Dan Storper, the founder and CEO of Putumayo World Music, a record label that specializes in compilations of world music, jazz, and blues. So Dan, obviously Putumayo has covered a very, very wide range of music, everything from Celtic to Hispanic, blues, jazz, which I mentioned. What is the spark? How do you initiate a album? What is the magic that occurs at that moment?
Well, it's a combination of factors. I keep a long list of albums and themes and regions of the world that I'd like to explore in these compilations. And in a way now it's a little more interesting because we continue to release CDs, but we've also started offering digital compilations, small EP, 5-song EPs that give us a little more flexibility about being able to explore areas that we haven't yet. We're beginning to do that more and more. And so I think the thing that really has probably most influenced me is the sense I have when I hear a couple of great songs that fit a specific theme. It's sometimes just one song, and I'll say, that needs an album, and I know what that album is, and it's time to do that. And, you know, there are many of us who are in the record business who have our favorite music, and I'll be the first to say that, you know, particularly a fan of Afro-Latino music and Brazilian music, and increasingly Americana and blues and jazz as I've lived here in the region for a while. But I think what happens is sometimes you'll just hear a song and say, oh, it's time to do that. And, you know, when we had a very successful Italian album called Italian Cafe, it was because, you know, we've been assembling a lot of wonderful Italian songs, some with a vintage flavor. We first did French Cafe, which is the first French album we did back in the 90s. It was a time when, you know, French chanson was still somewhat popular, but not well known. So I think the idea is we don't want to repeat or offer something that is all over the place, you know, and we're selecting based usually on melodies, and the idea of a beautifully sung song. Most of our songs are vocals, a few are instrumentals, but, and then there are times when, for instance, our yoga series that we started, it was time for relaxing music, time for music to meditate and to practice yoga with. So luckily, what exists here in New Orleans is this network, and there's a guy named Sean Johnson, wonderful musician, and he basically co-curated the yoga albums with me and wrote the liner notes and helped guide people along with yoga practice. So, and he's working with me on a new album for the new year on actually African music for yoga. So that's the kind of thing that happens when you're in New Orleans. I remember, you know, meeting some Celtic music people who gave me suggestions. There's even Carrie, and we did an album called Cowboy Playground, and Carrie, a wonderful guy, who's a great musician. We've found resources all over, not just the world, but here in New Orleans to help us with the selections. And so thematically, it you know, we don't want to repeat ourselves constantly, but there are certain themes, like we did an album called Afro-Cubano, which came out a couple of months ago. And it is the kind of music that I consider to be the best. And in fact, not the best, but, you know, one of my favorites. And what's so great about Afro-Latino music, or Afro-Congo to Cuba is another album we did years ago, is my experience of the blending of music from different cultures. The African musicians tend to take the hard edge off of the music and integrate it into their, I don't know exactly how to characterize it. I will say, once I was in Senegal and I was in a little club and listening to an African band that was playing Latin music, mostly salsa-based music, and that blend with the marimba and, you know, instruments that were basically used in African music just created a sublime, beautiful variation or version of Latin music. So it's that blending, like Brazil, where you have Portuguese meets African meets the New World. You know, that blending of music and sounds is a big part of what Putumayo has often focused on.
Of course, that's very much the sound of New Orleans, exactly. As well, all part exactly. of that sphere. So I'm holding this album cover, Putumayo Presents Afro-Cubano. And one thing that's always struck me is your albums have a very distinct brand. There's always a beautiful work of art, and it's been by the same artist, I assume, for most of the time. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, again, another little coincidence, but Nicola Heindel is a British illustrator, British artist, happened to be a friend of the woman that did the displays for our New York store, retail shop. And it turns out I had been in London one trip and I'd bought a greeting card that she had actually created at a store in London. And I had it on my bulletin board in my office. And it turns out that the woman doing the displays for Putumayo was a good friend of Nicola's and said, you know, that card that you have on your bulletin board, my friend did that. In fact, she's coming to New York in a few days. You want to meet her? And so that led to meeting her. And she initially, before we had started the record label, did a few illustrations for our retail shops. And then when we were starting the record label, I thought that seems like the kind of art that would reflect what Putumayo is all about. So we invited her to do the first covers and continued over the years.
Well, they're very distinctive. And I'm in a checkout lane at Whole Foods. These always draw my attention. I'm always amazed by the beauty of them. So one thing you've done in recent years is you've had an offshoot called Putumayo Kids. Tell me about that.
Sure. Early on, someone came to me, it was a teacher in New York, and said, you know, you've got all these great albums for adults and I play them in my kids' classroom, but I think it would be great. You'd probably enjoy and it might be successful if you started doing albums specifically oriented for kids, teaching kids about the world. And that led to the first album for kids that we did in 1998 called World Playground, and a whole playground series that ultimately over the years became successful. And then later, lullabies for kids, helping put kids to sleep or take naps during the day. And so we did an album called Dreamland, and then a series of Dreamland albums. So the idea really was to provide kids, oftentimes the songs would be adult songs that were just kid friendly. But check, make sure the lyrics were okay and kid friendly. And that's what led to a whole kids division. And in recent years, we've started distributing children's books, multicultural children's books as well. So one of the things I like as I travel around the country is to be able to kind of offer this combination of music and books about the world together. I kind of feel like that helps kids get a better sense of the more positive sides of these other cultures that are oftentimes depicted as, you know, poor, downtrodden, disease-ridden, without much positive reflections in the news. And so I think it's important to get a sense of the duality that exists.
I think it's an amazing geography and cultural study for children to be able to learn through music. So we're going to close out the interview by coming back to what we first talked about, which is the new album that you co-curated with Linda Ronstadt, Putumayo Presents Feels Like Home, Songs from the Sonoran Borderlands. And we're going to listen to one of the songs on this album. It's Linda Ronstadt singing El Sueño. So tell us what El Sueño is all about.
Sure. It's what's called a huapango. It's a folk tune from Mexico that she recorded from her on her second album, Mas Canciones, her second Latin album, with her brothers, Peter and Mike. And so they basically helped out. They're, you know, the family, it's funny, I could read this. This is a little, great little quote. I haven't read it yet on air anywhere. So I think she talks about music for the family, which really, and the family played on several songs on the Feels Like Home album. The itch to make music is a marker that unites generations of Ronstadts. It's one of those stubborn traits we have, like those circus families where everyone from baby to grandma can twist themselves into pretzels and nearly fly. So I think the idea is that, you know, it's a big part of her cultural background. And so El Sueño happens to be the second song on the album, and it follows a wonderful track by Lalo Guerrero with Ry Cooter, basically talking about the old days, the old ways, and kind of Barrio Viejo, the old town. So El Sueño is the second track on the album. And, you know, it highlights her voice, which, you know, increasingly as she got more practice in singing in Spanish, I think she got better and better at it.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you for really contributing to the richness of the world's music heritage and sharing it with so many people.
Well, thanks for having me on your show and helping spread the word.
And here we go with El Sueño.
Mi cantar dirá que estoy muy contento. Yo canto por divagar esta pasión que yo siento y que no puedo olvidar. Me acuesto pensando en ti. Y en el sueño estás conmigo y me siento tan feliz al soñar que estoy contigo. Noche que soñé que tu boquita besaba y luego que desperté fui viendo que era la almohada la que de besos colmé. Me acuesto pensando en ti y en el sueño estás conmigo y me siento tan feliz al soñar que estoy contigo. Me cansé de soñar. El sueño me hace sufrir. Quisiera que al despertar mi sueño fuera verdad para dejar de sufrir. Me acuesto pensando en ti y en el sueño estás conmigo y me siento tan feliz al soñar.
And welcome to Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat Magazine. I am thrilled today to be joined by Brandon Broussard, a native of Lafayette, who's a public school educator. He also teaches dance, which he's done for 20 years, Cajun and Creole and Zydeco dance. He's organizing an event of cultural immersion here in New Orleans of Louisiana food, dance, live music, and cultural presentations at multiple venues from October 21st through the 23rd. Build under the title Love of Dance. You'll be able to find more at the website, Louisiana Dance Roots, roots.com, which also has links to all of his events. And he's going to describe each of them for us. So welcome to the show, Brandon. Happy to have you here today.
Thank you.
So Brandon, tell us all about these events you're organizing and what our listeners could expect.
So the event on Friday will have dance lessons earlier in the day at the dance club. And I built a really good foundation with them since summer before last, giving lessons here in New Orleans. And it'll proceed on over to Maison Dupuis.
On Friday?
Yes.
Same day. Okay.
Same day. There'll be a cultural presentation. It'll be a pre-recorded interview with Marie, actually Marie Isabel, that's playing that night and by UGG. And then they'll have a dance lesson that I'll give. And then they'll have the live music, something that I've been working on through my years of teaching in general, specifically dance, is what I call dance share. So modern dance instructors will refer to this as energy share, kind of mirroring energy from someone in the room. But for me, it's become much more prevalent and clear that that's how I learned how to dance. Because people would normally ask me, how did you learn how to dance the wind? I can't pinpoint any time. Right? Most people that I know from Lafayette area have not taken lessons. They just naturally do it, whether it's watching or dancing with someone that knows how to dance, their mother, their grandpa. That's kind of the general scheme of things. However, over time, as things change, it's getting less and less of that happening, or that's what I've witnessed. And so I'm typically someone that sees voids and fills them. I don't necessarily have an end goal on those projects that I work on. So this dance share definition that you'll see on Eventbrite on the link to give somebody some sort of idea, it's a lot of things that connect dots, right? So it's not just the dance instruction that I think most people are accustomed to. I do give private lessons. I do give group lessons. I talk a little bit about the culture, and I try to bring in a little bit of somatic therapy of you know, what I've seen work in the past, but it's pretty cut and dry. This dance share thought process of mine is, again, things that I've witnessed myself and seen happen. And so it's a combination of safety from the person that you're dancing with, the combination of feeling secure, connection, and also flow of that energy. So I've never danced with myself, but I've had a lot of follows come to me and say, I've never danced before, and I followed everything that you did. I've had several people that I've danced with that I've never have danced with. People that don't know either of us will come up to us and say, man, y'all must have been danced for years. I'm like, we just met, and they just don't understand that process. From what I hear from people is that I offer that safety at that moment, and it's like that holding space. I'm never going to over dance someone or under dance, because that's never fun. Either one of them is not fun on that spectrum. But I just have, for some reason, the ability to know what that person's able to do with no verbal communication. And they just feel safe.
So somebody who may be reluctant to, like, let's say, to get out on a Cajun dance floor, because you see these people who just seem to be naturally able to do it. You're saying somebody who may have trepidation about it can come to this and kind of have a mental lesson in some ways on how to feel at ease and, mm-hmm. and go out there and do the traditional steps.
Yes. It's all about movement. But again, all those other things I've mentioned are extremely important. another thing that's in the definition that I've developed that may evolve over time, but it's the live music, right? I mean, you can dance the recordings all day long, but that resonation from the instruments, but also the energy from the musicians, right? So that's another component of this, a component of this event regarding having the musicians being interviewed from the aspect of their love of dance. A lot of musicians don't dance, but what is their connection to the dancer, right? A lot of these musicians that'll be playing, Marie Isabel with Tina Marie and Bayou Juju on Friday, if you've watched her music live, she's gonna get out into the crowd and probably dance while she's fiddling. Jeffrey Broussard is going to play Saturday. He does that all the time. Completely connects with the crowd. He's feeling their energy. They're feeling his. And that's kind of where the magic comes from. Like, you forget where you are, right? It's pretty much like a mindfulness situation.
Oh, I would say the few times I've been to Cajun dance halls, yes, you definitely feel a certain energy among all the participants in the room. So you mentioned on Saturday. Now, where is that event taking place?
That's going to be at the Mudlark Public Theater. Mm-hmm. On Murray Street.
Yes.
That's going to be a collaboration with Jeffrey Broussard and Romain Boix that has a jazz band Sabretooth Swing in New Orleans. Very awesome collaborator and musician. They've recorded together in the past, and so they will be working on a Zydeco and blues fusion.
Great. Wow, you've got all the Louisiana genres covered here, yeah. Obviously.
We're working on that.
You come from Acadiana, mm-hmm. and you said, dance kind of came naturally to you. What are your earliest memories of dancing?
So my earliest memories are literally being under the table. I was extremely shy as a child, extremely. And, you know, I don't have any siblings, but my family has a lot of, you know, I have a lot of cousins and aunts and uncles. And so there were always weddings. There were always family reunions. There was always, every holiday we got together, and it was, you know, 50 to 100 people, depending on the time frame of the day. And there was card playing, there was dancing, you know, and everything. So I literally would be under the table.
Watching. Seeing all those legs.
Yeah, watching, and, you know, and just being so shy about doing it, you know. And then getting into adolescent years, high school years, there's a few places that we were able to go dance as adolescents or high school children when we were able to drive. And I kind of always told that I was a wild dancer, so it kind of kept me somewhat submissive even at that moment.
And what were you dancing to in high school? Was it the traditional Cajun stuff or stuff that most high school? Oh, yeah, so yeah, was, very traditionally tied then.
Yeah, we would go on a bunch of tri rides that existed. They don't exist anymore, but a bunch of tri rides, and there was maybe 8 to 10 of them that happened throughout the year, mostly in the fall, and it was a weekend. And at night there were dances. So yeah, I was always kind of told I was a wild dancer. Didn't really know what that meant. I was literally just feeling the music and doing my movements, you know, that my body wanted to do it. And it wasn't until about 2004, 2005, I went to the Blue Moon in Lafayette. I was asked if I'd ever been. I'm like, no, I've never been. And like, I can't believe I've never been there. So I instantly saw 5 to 6 male leads. And if I could have mirrored them, I would have been like, that's exactly what I do. That's my movements. And I instantly feel comfortable. None of these people ever took dance instruction that I'm talking about. And we all have very similar styles. And so it gave me, you know, a sense of willingness and not looking back. I just like, this is what I've always been moving like, so I'm going to keep doing it. And I really kind of flourished with confidence after that. I would always like help people out on the dance floor. Somebody that knew I was a teacher, like, oh, why don't you teach them? Began to understand that I like doing this and I don't have to be ashamed of it, but I still didn't really know what I was doing. And so
it's interesting you say that, because when I see Cajun dancing, you know, there seems to be like a formal waltz, you know, there's a distinct way that these dances are done and as partners, but you're saying there's often a really individual style to each person.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm very observant in general. And so when I'm teaching this, I'm coming from the perspective of, I don't expect you to dance like I do. Because if you go to Mamou or you go to Lake Charles or you go to Lafayette or Houma, you're going to have a conversation with someone, whether it's verbal or a dance conversation, and something's just not going to be right. You're going to be like, what are you doing? I mean, I've heard it happen so many times, and they'll say, I'm doing two-step, and the other person will say, I'm doing two-step, and they're not doing the same step. I don't like putting things in boxes, so I like to try to pick out different areas of things that I've seen and incorporate that, you know, depending on where I am, or do my best to explain that process.
Now, you were teaching dance in Lafayette? Because you've recently moved to New Orleans.
Yeah, I'm making that transition here. I've taught lessons here in New Orleans since summer before last, so just over a year. I've done some group workshops, hour and a half time frame, and some one-on-one and couple dance lessons, but most of them have been done in Latvia and surrounding areas, Iberia.
Now, we didn't get to Sunday. What's happening on Sunday at the
So on Sunday, that was my biggest accomplishment, I think, in general, although all the musicians are amazing in my opinion. It'll be at Tipitina's. Bruce Dagerbaum will be playing, which he only plays once a month now. So I contacted him because we've talked over the years, and I've been telling him that I wanted to work with him, and he's always wondering when. Just so happened that was the day that was open, and that's the day he's playing. So we've collaborated. I'll give a dance lesson at Tipitina's, which I'm really excited about, just to have
big
that
space,
opportunity.
Yes.
And there'll be a cultural presentation there of Bruce. Actually, it'll be pre-recorded. Yeah, he's just a phenomenal guy. You don't hear about him at all in Lafayette or anywhere else, I think, besides New Orleans or where he travels. You know, he has original music, a great guy, great stand-up guy. So I was really wanting to have him participate in some aspects. So
his Cajun Fado Doze are legendary here, and everybody was thrilled when they finally returned after COVID, of course. But it's not just Cajun and Zydeco. You're also going to do some New Orleans jazz and some blues as well. How would you distinguish all these dance styles related to these different genres of music?
It's hard to, but I try to keep an open mind. I try to think back about how things might have been, which no one really knows. And I kind of have compared to most of my friends in Lafayette area, some friends have two extra generations in between their grandparents. So my grandparents were born in 1908, 1909. Both grandparents had each one of my parents when they were 40, and my parents had me when they were 30. So there's a huge gap. And so as a child, I would listen to the older adults and those people. And so, you know, pre-World War II, there were house dances mostly. There were some outlying bars that they would go dance at, but they were small spaces. They weren't large. If you consider the size and space, they're not doing probably the two-step counterclockwise that you see after World War II, right, at rectangular dance halls. The space changes your movements. The temperature changes your movements, right? I mean, all these things change. So I really try to, I don't know if it's putting people at ease when they're taking the lessons, you know, whether they know nothing about the culture or anything, but I mean, it's important to talk about, but at the same time, it's, you know, in that moment, it's about them learning something. So I try to put their mind at ease. We don't really know, right? These are things that we do know. These are things we can postulate about, but in the moment we're just moving, right? You're just dancing.
Right. Yeah. The motion feels right to the music, I guess, no matter what the era you're in. You have moved, obviously, from Acadiana to New Orleans. What's that transition like? They are very different parts of Louisiana. We're a very diverse state.
Yes. There's a lot of code switching, right? Verbal and physical, like dancing-wise. And it's a huge curve that I've had to just kind of, you know, navigate, you know, going back and forth. There's some similarities, but there's a lot of differences, right? As far as for culture, it's interesting to me because it's only 2 hours away, right? It's such drastic in culture, which is something that I'm kind of, I think, being more keen about when I'm talking about it. I wouldn't identify as Cajun, I would identify as Creole. And that's just from my knowledge that I keep gaining about culture. Mm-hmm. My grandparents, one side identified as being French and the other side identified as being Parisian.
Fascinating, right?
Yeah, and my parents both would say they were Cajun.
Okay.
So the evolution of that word and the changing of that word and the meaning of that word has been fairly new when you consider the culture itself. And again, just like the dancing or food, every little pocket of Louisiana has their own definition or understanding of what that is. I try not to box things in or codify them, but at the same time, I want to be open. So it's kind of murky sometimes, but I do my best to be open about it. And I'm not going to, you know, tell someone they're not what they identify with, you know, it's perfectly fine. I've changed just because of what I see, you know, through reading and understanding what history was. I feel like Creole is a lot more inclusive. And I feel like when you get into the dancing aspect, which I don't see most people talking about, but, and not to get too depth, you know, too deep into it, but it's kind of hard for me to use Cajun and Zydeco. If Jeffrey Broussard is playing the fiddle, it's just kind of hard for me to sample a Cajun dance to that band from an ethical standpoint. again, I try to keep it open. I just feel like Creole is a little bit more all inclusive regarding culture. And again, I had a catering business for 8 years focusing on Cajun and Creole food. And so I have an undergraduate in agriculture education. So when I think back about history of food and what things were used and were not used, you know, lack of refrigeration, there's a lot of things that I see that are staples, but weren't always staples. You know, they kind of evolve over time. You know, the Holy Trinity with food, right? Before refrigeration, it couldn't happen because those three things don't grow at the same time. So same with dancing, you know, things evolve and change, and I think that's fine. You know, I just like there being an understanding of that change.
Yes, you know, Louisiana is a very difficult place to just give a one-size-fits-all definition to.
It's so hard.
We'll be right back. We're going to take a brief pause for the cause, and I will be back to discuss more with Brandon Broussard.
From the Lower Nine to Uptown, Mid-City to the West Bank, we've got you covered, New Orleans. WHIV 102.3 FM.
And we're back with Beat Cafe here on WHIV 102.3. I'm your host, David Johnson, and I am joined today by Brandon Broussard, who is organizing a series of cultural immersion events over the weekend of October 21st through the 23rd that will include dance, live music, food, and cultural presentations at multiple locations. You'll be able to learn more by visiting the website Louisiana Dance Roots, RoutesRoutes.com, which also has a link to tickets. Now, Brandon, we've mentioned earlier you're relatively new to New Orleans. You're from Acadiana, and you've come here to pursue more education in social work. And how has that influenced your interest in dance and culture?
It's interesting because for years, especially when I would teach like a group or couples in a series, let's just say a 6 or 8 week series, I would tell them jokingly, but serious at the same time, that sometimes this becomes a counseling session. And I have like three rules. And one rule is like, don't look down at your feet because you forget you have hands, you know, for safety reasons. The second one, don't stop because it becomes habitual. And the third one is like, you can't argue or bicker until the third lesson. And you get just everyone that was in a relationship. Oh, we've been married for 50 years. We love each other. We never argue. And that was always the ones that within 5 seconds, right? They're kind of bickering and
you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. And so I would be very light about it. I'm stuck looking at them and kind of laughing and they start laughing and like, oh yeah, we said we weren't going to do that. But it really is, right? It's about the connection. It's about understanding. It's about respect. It's about, yes, you have a lead and a follow, but that doesn't really mean that the lead's in full control. Right? They're just leading you, they're guiding you. And I think that's a very misunderstood concept of that dance or couples dance in general. Bringing a lot of the social work information that I've been studying and absorbing and so forth, it's just become very aware, I'm becoming more self-aware that there is a lot of therapeutic activities happening, psychoanalytic theory. If you look at it, it's all about what dancing is really. If you're looking for that, right? You know, maybe the normal person just wants to take a dance lesson and you're done. But if you're actually devoting a lot of time to it, again, a 6 or 8 week course, or you're a couple that's taking multiple lessons to actually learn it, you can see that transition happening.
Yeah, there's definitely a therapeutic side. Yeah. Like you said, it's a release. It's a creative release.
It's a total release.
It puts endorphins in your head.
Yeah, it's a total release. So that's been an interesting concept for me to really see and actually hear people say, wow, that was super healing. And I would just kind of fluff it off, like, oh, yeah, sure. But I'm really beginning to see that. So I feel like my lessons are kind of turning more towards that, you know, process of actually making it some sort of therapy approach.
Well, you brought an accordion to our interview today, and you're going to do a brief demonstration for us. So I'll let take over the squeeze box here.
Sure. So I don't really play music. I like to say I fiddle with the accordion. I bought it as a hobby, just to play it, some jams and so forth. And I put it up in the closet and paid up enough money for it where I told myself I need to do it, you know, use it for something. I started using it in my dance classes, and I don't necessarily play songs on it, but I'll use the bass side to resonate on what their feet should be doing and what they should be moving to. It's obviously on me, so I'm able to literally get a foot from this person so they can literally feel the resonating vibes from the accordion. I can increase the tempo. I can decrease the tempo. It's very hard to do if you're playing just a song that's recorded. And I use that increase and decrease in tempo for the actual activities, you know, that I'm teaching them. And so it just seems to marry really well. It's what they're listening to anyways, right, when this music is playing. So it's, I think, less abstract for them when they're actually dancing. So for the waltz, for example, you'll hear in the lesson, if I'm using the accordion, and typically the waltzes are not sped up or slowed, you know, slowed down during live music. But there's a lot of musicians that are playing faster songs, two-step songs, sonical songs that will play to the crowd, and they'll get faster and, you know, so forth. Tina by Ujiju does this. Pinely Boys is very famous for doing that. If I'm doing the two-step with my students regarding teaching them, you'll hear. And I'll tell them, you know, we'll start one tempo. And that's typically the tempo that I'm using, about 100 beats per minute. And then once they get comfortable with that, we'll do some other exercises. And I'm scanning and reading their abilities at that point. But then I'll tell them, okay, I'm going to increase and decrease the tempo. And I want you to try to assimilate to that speed, right? So I might start off with the same tempo that we just had. And then slow down and speed up. And again, I've mentioned mindfulness earlier on, but it becomes repetitive to some extent, which helps with the muscle memory, but they're not thinking about anything else, right, in those moments. It's kind of a form of intensity where it's like that's all they're focused on. It works. It definitely works. I kind of feel out of place if I don't have it.
Well, that's good. It's a great teaching tool, obviously, you know, sound and motion, you know, yeah. It all goes hand in hand, of course. That's the whole notion of dance. Now, of course, no Louisiana celebration is complete without food. And you mentioned earlier that you worked in catering. But what can visitors expect at these events and on the food side?
On the food side, the VIP event, which is also on Sunday, it's going to be a brunch. I'm partnering with a friend of mine that's from Thibodeau, that's a really good cook as well. And so that event will have food at it, and we're still deciding what that'll be, but it'll definitely be something local. The Mudlark will probably have some sort of pop-up because of their location. Tipitina's will have red beans, and Maison Dupuy doesn't have any sort of kitchen. It is in the quarter, so we're not really certain about that. And it's something that we hope to continue to incorporate in, right, in other events, but it's kind of the whole gamut, right? People that have came to my dance lessons, some for last, I would cook something and bring it. And I had the dance lesson for an hour and a half, and then have a band play at the dance quarter. So T-Marie and Bayou Gigi played, and then I had another band play the other day. So for me, it's just the whole experience just changes the whole vibe and helps with the learning process, I think.
Now, you mentioned, obviously, you gained your knowledge of dance by just being in these weddings and these events and these dance halls as a little kid. Where did your knowledge of food come from? Same, like, yeah. Obviously genetic through the family line.
Yeah, I guess, you know, biogenetics at some point. I mean, one of my grandparents, my grandmother cooked all the time. I'm pretty sure she could have been a chef. She actually had a few recipes that some restaurants did use, bread pudding and her tarts that she made. And she learned actually from her husband's mother, because her mother died when she was really young and no recipes written down whatsoever. And so when I decided I wanted to start catering, I went to visit her, and she was older this time and had stopped cooking a whole lot, but she'd just take random coffee cups out of the cupboard, you know, and fill it up halfway with this ingredient, fill it up halfway with that. Then I'd go another time, and it was another mug, same recipe, but another mug. I'm like, oh my God. And so I'm trying to literally not to make her angry or like I wasn't listening to her. I was, but it seemed so inconsistent to me. But it was super consistent. She just knew how much to put in.
Of course. Right?
And a lot of people are like that. And so I went back several times, and I would just say, I just learn it one more time, you know, and I would memorize what cup she used and how much she put in it. And I would go back after she left, and I would, you know, and then I would get my family that had eaten her food their whole life, like, taste this and tell me if this is what it's supposed to taste like. And so that's how I developed the recipes, actually, taste testing. I had a catering, a mobile catering business. I'm not saying they weren't any mobile catering business at that time, but there wasn't any individuals doing it. This was 2008. There were restaurants that had that opportunity, but not individuals. And so I, because I have a welding background and taught that as well as an agriculture teacher, I made all my equipment, outfitted the trailer. And so I met Bruce Degerpont, which will be playing on Sunday during my first catering event. My second event was Festivals International, that me and my dad cooked 5,000 servings for in 5 days.
And what were you serving?
We had cabbage rolls, bread pudding, red beans and rice, and I believe some sort of bisque the first year.
That's a lot of cooking.
Yeah, I had no idea how much I was cooking until like a week or two later. And then I did a lot of pro bono work for a group of people in Lafayette that was trying to get the Congre Mondial to come back to Louisiana.
I've heard of them. What exactly is that again?
It's an Acadian festival, but it has to be held. It's every 5 years, and it has to be held where there's Acadian descent, but the area has to be able to accommodate a certain amount of people.
So that includes Nova Scotia, I assume. It can Nova be there Scotia, or Brunswick, here in Louisiana's Maine, Acadiana, right?
Louisiana.
Yeah.
And so they were trying to get it to come back here 1 year, and so hot, you know, August 15th is Acadian National Holiday and all this other.
A lot cooler in Nova Scotia.
Yeah. And so we put up, you know, a lot of time to get it come back here, and it didn't. And we're trying to get the 2009 Congre come back, and it didn't. So I did a lot of pro bono work with catering to get those people to come here. And it paid off for me because I was awarded a free trip to go to the Congre 2009. And me and Chef Roy cooked together for a couple weeks up there.
And you're cooking traditional Louisiana food for Canadians.
I drove up there with my trailer, and it was quite an experience.
Did you see any similarities in what they were serving in Canada compared to what the Cajun immigrants? I mean, obviously, when the Acadian exiles arrived here, they had to rely on native foods.
Of course.
And the people who are already cooking here, I assume indigenous people and the existing French population.
You know, it's a melting pot, as you know, right?
Yeah.
So who knows when things started? You know, you can postulate all day long about things, which I like doing, but no, there's no similarities whatsoever. The only thing that I've heard about was, I mentioned cabbage rolls. Someone that I met in Canada years before I started catering was in Lafayette for Festivals of Cania, and they came to my booth and had cabbage rolls. Like, oh my God, this reminds me of my grandma. And I knew she was from Acadie. I'm like, what? Explain that to me. And she's like, I don't know, she would cook it. And then, you know, through the catering process, I met someone from Poland that says, oh man, this is so similar to what I remember as a kid, Poland, South America, you know, so it's a peasant dish, that one in particular, which is what they were here pretty much, right, when they moved here. So, there's a lot of crossovers with food and dance.
Part of that larger cultural immersion that you're talking about, this event will be very, very focused upon, like I said, in dance, live music, food, and cultural presentations. Like, you can find out more again at louisianadanceroots.com, and that's roots, r-o-o-t-s, and you'll also be able to find a link for tickets. And we're going to close out the show by actually listening to some music from one of the bands that Brandon has mentioned, and that is T. Marie and the Bayou Juju. How did you come to become familiar with her and the band?
Dancing. I dance quite a bit with Marie in Lafayette, Marie Isabel, quite often, most festivals and so forth. And I've been knowing her for, I don't even know how long. I'd say at least 15 to 20 years. And she's been in New Orleans for about 10 now. During COVID, she started this band, and it's evolved a little bit, but I'm really impressed with the music.
All right, we're going to give it a listen and get your dancing shoes on, get your appetite built up, and get your brain wired for all things Louisiana for the upcoming events, October 21st through the 23rd. Thank you, Brandon. Enjoyed having you here today.
Thank you.
WHIV 102.3 FM.